Today's podcast is sponsored by Zencastr. I use Zencastr to record the Tally Room podcast, and it's an invaluable tool. I record pretty much every episode of this show remotely, with my guests joining me from wherever they happen to be. Zencastr allows us to record with high-quality sound, even if the internet connection isn't the best. It records a high-quality version on the local desktop and then uploads it when the internet connection allows, meaning that the audio the listeners hear is usually better than what I can hear when I'm recording. It also allows for recording video. I use it to be able to view my guests, but you can also record video in 1080p. On one or two occasions, I've used Zoom instead, and you really notice a difference. It's super easy to use Zencastr. I set up a link for a recording and send it to my guests, and we're getting started in minutes. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use my code TALLYROOM, and you'll get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr paid plan. I want you to have the same easy experience as I do for all my podcasting needs. It's time to share your story. Welcome to the Tally Room Podcast. I'm Ben Rowie. Queenslanders will soon be going to the polls to elect local councillors for the next 4 years. These elections will cover some of the largest councils in Australia, including the city of Brisbane. There will also be two by-elections for state seats held on the same day. I have two guests today. My first guest is Alexis Pink. Alexis comes to us from Brisbane community radio station 4ZZZ and is the first reporter working out of the state press gallery for the station in 15 years. Hello, Alexis.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. My second guest is Andrew Messenger. Andrew is a Queensland state reporter for The Guardian Australia. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for coming on. So the city of Brisbane has a population of 1.25 million people, while nearby Gold Coast and Moreton Bay councils are the second and third most populous councils in Australia. Brisbane has been ruled by the LNP for the last 16 years. Campbell Newman won the mayoralty in 2004, but his party really came to power when his Liberal team won the council majority 4 years later in 2008. Alexis, do you think there's a prospect of the LNP losing their grip on the council in 2024?
Geez, it's a tough one, to be honest. Without any actual polling to tell us a lot about what's going on the ground, it's hard to really say definitively that something is definitely going to happen. But there certainly is a bit of an air of an interest in change, even if the current electoral system in Brisbane City Council is not likely to give them a lot of hope inside the Labor Party right now. There are definitely some seats that are looking a little bit on the weak side. Certainly, Enoggera is high up on that list. Its margin's really, really short. So Enoggera is probably going to be one of the easiest targets on the ALP's list. And this could be the election. Last time around, it was Jonty Bush who was running for that. Jonty's now elected to state government. So the Labor Party has chosen Taylor Wojcicki, and that's against Andrew Wines. Andrew Wines has quite a history in politics, so that could be quite difficult for the LNP to hold on to. Though right now, the Greens do have quite a good set of credentials in that seat and could be quite competitive if things do go a little bit skew-iff for Labor as well. They're on 16.1 there from the 2020 result, but certainly bigger results from the federal election may be an indicator that things might be about to happen.
And Andrew, more broadly in Brisbane, outside of any particular ward, there's this interesting dynamic of there being kind of two opposition parties, that Labor and the Greens are both competing, with the Greens looking quite strong.
Yeah, that's right. I think Labor has proven not a very effective opposition party in the last sort of 20 years or so, and has steadily lost both seats and also vote count. They've certainly lost wards and haven't really threatened the Lord Mayor in a long time. But now it's sort of a race for second, I suppose, between those two in some way, because Jono Sriranganathan, who is the former Gabba councillor and extremely high profile in Queensland media, is running for Lord Mayor. And I suppose that profile and some of the headline-grabbing ideas he's come up with will very likely at least make either Labor voters or potentially Labor-leaning Liberal voters change their vote over to a third option, particularly for people who just 2 years ago voted Green or preferenced them in federal parliament.
Well, there certainly does seem to be a little bit of worry in the LNP camp about Green's contests, especially around the inner city and out into the west, where Michael Berkman represents a lot of that area and state, and where Elizabeth Watson Brown represents them in federal parliament. So they're looking at places like Walter Taylor and Pullenvale and Paddington. And There's certainly a little bit to be said in the way that the LNP is approaching this campaign. They have been putting out quite significant attack ads against the candidates in Central and Walter Taylor and in Holland Park, but they haven't done much about the Gabba or in Paddington. I suspect it might be that they think that Paddington is already lost for the LNP. And certainly on the margin from the last election, it certainly could be the case.
Last election, Paddington was unbelievably close, and this held at the very early stages of COVID, so perhaps that was a bonus for any incumbent anywhere on any level of government.
Certainly that COVID effect really did. Not a single seat changed hands. Everyone's political affiliation stayed exactly the same across the council.
Incredibly boring election.
Oh my gosh, it was.
Well, Andrew, before we came on, you were talking about the historical context that over a number of decades, the trend has all been in one direction, that the LNP has continued to gain seats from Labor. But while that's been going on, like the shape of the non-LNP vote in the council has changed quite dramatically, right? And there's a blog post I've got going up before this podcast comes out that has some charts showing those vote trends and those seat trends. But what are your thoughts on, like, what has changed in, you know, traditionally this would be considered like one of the most pure two-party systems in Australian politics, where, you know, as recently as 2000, the Greens only ran in one ward, there was a bunch of indies, but it was largely Labor versus Liberal everywhere. And now it is fascinating that this council has become quite a three-party contest, even if the electoral system kind of makes the result look a bit more two-party, despite the voting system kind of making that harder.
I think a lot of that goes down to just the rise of the Greens, right? It's just as simple as the Green Party has all of these people that they've trained up and employ people in elected offices, but also just members, and they've got an election coming, so they may as well use them, right? But also I think that there certainly is a swing in Labor. Labor has struggled to be competitive for a long time, and I think that there's an element of the party that said we're going to sort of give up a bit and we're unlikely to really challenge much, except in the outer suburban areas. And I think you can hear that a little bit in their sort of narrative. But definitely the city of Brisbane, I don't think there's a single issue you can point to as a reason for that, though. There's not like been a shift in the ideology or the material demands of people who live here necessarily. It's just the way perhaps other levels of government have shifted, and that's changed the way people vote at lower levels.
So I might challenge that a little bit. Certainly the actual material living in Brisbane hasn't changed a lot. What has changed is the Greens' approach to campaigning. The 2000, 2004, 2008 elections were elections where the Greens were very unfocused as a political party. They had their environmental issues, but they did talk a lot about state issues in local elections. And with that sort of muddled sort of approach to the electorates, people just didn't know what they were going to get with the Greens in council. But at the point that Jonathan Taranganathan made it into council and the narratives inside the Greens started to change from purely environmental ones to ones of much more social welfare approaches, there's been a sort of click between the approach that the Greens have been taking and what the electorate has wanted to hear on things like housing and social welfare and other things like that. And those, some of those issues do apply at council. And one of the things you do see in Jono's approach to these sorts of things is the focus on developments and making sure that the city is climate adaptable and dealing with homeless issues, which are very not totally council-driven, but certainly much more council-driven than, say, focusing on the Great Barrier Reef, for example, which is a mistake that the Greens have made in the past.
I remember when I first encountered the Queensland Greens, they had this problem that every other state around the country had some form of proportional representation that they could use at the council level, at the state level, usually both. The Greens won seats on local councils in Sydney and inner city level in the 90s. They were winning seats. They were single member wards in Melbourne, but they were very small single member wards in small areas that the Greens could win in the early 2000s. And they had upper houses everywhere. You know, the Greens have had at least one safe seat at every election in New South Wales in the upper house since the 90s. And it meant that they didn't have to reach that level. And for a long time, I think the Queensland Greens struggled to have maturity because they didn't have representatives. They didn't even have local councillors. But it meant, except for winning a senator, Every other seat they can potentially win is a single member majoritarian system, and it requires more focus and a more successful campaign to get any representation at all. But once you do that, you're kind of set up for more success. Alexis, in particular, do you think there's a logic to that, that that's something that's helped? It was a hard grind for the Greens, but once they've gotten over that hurdle, it's actually made them a lot stronger. And, you know, maybe that explains why we've got three Queensland Greens members in the House of Representatives and none from, you know, Sydney or Perth.
Well, certainly that has been the big change, right? Getting one of them across the line was the big thing, but also how that person got across the line as well. You have to give credit to Jono and their campaign manager at the time, now federal member for Griffith, Max Chandler-Mather, for thinking more clearly about what the electorate was looking for from the Greens, not just environmental issues, which do resonate quite well with younger audiences and do hit quite well with inner city audiences, but also about the material existence in which a lot of these people live. And just that switch, changing it from one to the other, was the big selling point. And that's what they went into state and federal elections with. And it was just very effective. It undermines Labor's very key positions in things like housing and social welfare. Those are issues that Labor traditionally win. So the Greens had finally found their place on the left and found a way to undermine Labor's credibility as a left of centre party.
Do you think state Labor in Queensland is comfortable governing alongside an LNP council? Whereas if the Greens were to win these wards, that has deep implications for potentially hurting Labor at a state or federal level. You know, that they've gotten into this equilibrium where Labor wins the state elections in these seats and the LNP wins the council elections in these seats. Whereas if the Greens break through there, that is more of a crisis for a state Labor government.
Pretty much since the creation of the Brisbane City Council 99 years ago, it has hated everything the state government does, and the state government has hated everything it does, and they've disagreed about a lot of stuff. That's just, as you say, an equilibrium. Under Joe, Clem Jones was at one point the highest ranking Labor figure in Australia. And at one point, Campbell Newman was the highest ranking Liberal figure in Australia as well. So it's gone both ways there. The benefit of having Liberals there for Labor is that under the Liberal Party, the council has a fairly conservative bent. Understandably, a conservative party is relatively conservative, but also it hasn't tried to upset the apple cart enormously towards the right. It's sort of been mostly happy just doing its own thing, except with regard to a couple of development issues, the Olympics and so on. I think if the Greens were running the place, yes, that would probably be a maybe not an existential threat to Labor, but certainly a constant annoyance. They would certainly both, as you have seen from the Greens election campaign, they want to use whatever power they can possibly get at whatever level of government they can possibly get it at to do the stuff they want to do, which would certainly get in the way or pose a lot of questions for the state Labor government.
There's certainly a lot to be said about that, but Labor parties around the country where they have been forced to go into coalition governments with the Greens have made a decent fist of it. They haven't just decided to make the Greens the official opposition. They've usually invited them in when it's become absolutely necessary. And there might be a way for a Labor government and a Greens council to deal with each other reasonably well, but it's hard to imagine that this won't get to a certain amount of animosity over a certain amount of time. Certainly the history between the Queensland Greens and Queensland Labor is quite fraught in itself. There's the time that Drew Hutton, one of the founders of the Queensland Greens, decided that they preference against Labor. The campaign strategist at the time for Labor was Kevin Rudd, and Kevin Rudd took that animosity into government in the federal parliament and dealt the Greens out of any negotiations on emissions trading. So that whole history has a point in Queensland, and that animosity has not gone away. You talk to the leaders of the Greens and the leaders of Labor today, and they will say that the other one was the primary reason why emissions trading in this country became Tony Abbott's go-to issue. So it's going to be tough to build those bridges up again.
Now, of course, if the LNP were to lose their majority, we're probably not going to be seeing a Labor majority or a Greens majority. We would be in a hung council situation. So it's probably worth mentioning a little bit about the constitutional structure of Brisbane City, because the Lord Mayor is quite a powerful executive Lord Mayor, which is unlike, at least outside of Queensland, how councils tend to work in other states, where the mayor is really a symbolic political leader of the council and is not the chief executive. That is very much not the case in Queensland and in Brisbane. So if the LNP lost power, it would matter whether the Greens or Labor won the mayoralty. That would be an important outcome. But if you look at a map, which again, will be up on some blog posts that are going to come up before this podcast comes out, but this map of Brisbane that shows which of the two centre-left parties made it to the two candidate preferred count in each seat. And you kind of have a picture of two Brisbanes. You've got an outer ring of Labor and you've got an inner circle of the Greens. And that minimizes a little bit how much mixture there is. Of course, there's a lot of Labor votes everywhere and there's a lot of Greens votes everywhere. But there seems like there is a little bit of potential there that the two parties could kind of stake out their own territory. Let's get back to that question about the mayoralty, like how important who wins that job is relative to the exact mix of who's on the council.
There's certainly something to be said for that. The leadership of Brisbane City Council is very important to how the council actually acts. It's why Campbell Newman didn't have that much trouble trying to out its ALP majority for the first 4 years of his time in office. This is probably going to be a repeat of that. This is where it gets a bit harder, though. Dragging Adrian Schrinner down to a level where he might be actually vulnerable to the Greens and Labor as a combined force seems tough even now. I mean, his primary vote from the last election was quite high. We were running 47.7%. Realistically, it'd need to come down more around the 40-41%. That was about the level at which the first Green seats in state government started falling. And I don't know. It's hard to say. Like, Adrian Schrinner is not exactly what you call a force of political nature. He's not charismatic in the same way that other leaders are. But he's well-known and well-respected in general in the electorate. Even if not everything he does is something you would like, you definitely know his name and you definitely know his counsel. It's going to be really hard to unseat him there. And Labor and the Greens have been using two different approaches to this. Labor's been saying, we're going to do everything the LNP is doing, only we're going to do it better and more ethically than the LNP is doing it. From the Greens side, they're saying, we're going to take a radical approach to changing the way that Brisbane City Council operates, be more consultative, be more community-focused, be more activist in a way. And both of those approaches are completely valid, but it's hard to figure out what those things give to a voter for this area that they aren't already getting from this government. Because most people still want the basic services of government to be the thing that they vote on. The roads, the rates, the rubbish, the developments that are happening around them. I don't know what's happening on those other two campaigns that would really sell people on changing their vote.
I think you actually need significantly lower than 40% personally because of optional preferential voting. But anyway, I don't see Adrian Schrinner losing the mayor position. I do perhaps see, in a very successful campaign, Labor and the Greens squeezing them out and winning a majority on council together. And in that sort of circumstance, I think it would certainly be an adjustment period. But the Liberal Party, as Alexis says, has dealt with that before. I do think that they would be able to, I don't know if they'd be able to manage that properly, because I think that dealing with two parties is harder than one. But it would certainly be interesting.
There is certainly something to be said about the personalities in these roles. Like, Campbell Newman was primed to undermine a Labor majority council. He was exactly the right person. He was charismatic. He was easygoing. He was approachable.
He had an agenda.
Yeah. The Labor majority weren't bad. They just got outplayed. With Adrian Schrinner, it's just not the same sort of person. He's sort of more a behind-the-scenes workhorse sort of person, and that's going to be harder for him to use as a lever against a minority council of Labor and Greens. He's going to be selling the idea that these guys are unstable and fractious, but if the Labor and Greens majority ends up being quite stable, there's just not a lot of argument to support that, and they might be in trouble by the time the next election comes around in 2028.
I would think that if you end up in a situation where, like, the LNP's got 12 councillors and you've got a slim majority for Labor and the Greens, that makes it a bit easier than if they had a united opposition. The Labor councillors are not particularly radical. They're not on board with the Greens' agenda. I think it'd be pretty easy to pick off at least a few of them to say, steady as she goes, we have a bit more transparency, a bit more accountability. Whereas I think if there was a centre-left mayor, like if there was a Labor mayor, they'd be like, what can I do to make sure that the Greens are on board with my agenda? And obviously, if you had a Greens mayor, well, that would be fascinating about what Labor would do in that position where Labor effectively would have the balance of power. But it seems to me that there's actually a lot of incentive there for Labor to not work with the Greens. And we did see that for a while there, Labor was talking about not giving preferences to the Greens, which they've now changed their mind on. And the other thing, I did want to come back to the optional preferential voting thing you mentioned, Andrew. I did the analysis on how preferences flowed and how they would have flowed if they were more like Brisbane seats at the state election, which uses compulsory preferential. And it cut the mayoral margin from like 6 point something down to the high threes. So it makes a big difference, and it actually flips three wards. The Greens win a second ward and Labor wins a sixth and seventh ward if you use compulsory preferential rather than optional preferential, because the centre-left vote is so evenly split. Whereas if you had a situation where all the left vote in the inner city was for the Greens and all the left vote in the outer suburbs was for Labor, it wouldn't matter that much. But in the current environment where that's so mixed, you do lose a lot of votes to exhaustion, and that compulsory preferential system would make a big difference to the centre-left.
What I'm fascinated to see is the Green message and the Green campaign is so focused on the inner city, and Labor's message, you know, not sure if their campaign is as focused as the Greens one, but certainly their message is more about the outer suburbs. So that you can sort of cancel out OPV by tanking in some seats and winning votes in other seats, or wards in this case, potentially. I'm not sure whether that will happen or not, but that would be very interesting if they could achieve a better outcome that way.
Something worth watching late on Saturday night, on election night.
I definitely think this year will be interesting. Last time was not interesting. I think this time will be interesting, and I'm very fascinated by what happens.
Yeah, I tend to agree. It's either going to be one of those nights where something just very dramatic happens, or at the very least, we're going to get close to something dramatic. There were inklings of that at the last election, but COVID really depressed the options for that. So this is going to be the one if it's going to be now.
The other thing I want to see, and I have no idea whether this will happen or not, is Brisbane is really facing a very serious housing crisis right at the moment. Rents have gone up a lot in the last 5 years, just before the last election. There's street homelessness, the sorts of things you see when you have a housing crisis. It's interesting to see whether people blame council for that, or whether they blame somebody else, like state government or federal government. I'm not sure what will happen there, but certainly if they blame council, it is a very serious problem, and perhaps that will shift vote.
Since we talked about COVID, it made an enormous difference to how people voted in 2020. Both back then, there was also council elections alongside state by-elections. And it was the first proper election that was held in this country during the COVID crisis. It was in the early weeks when we didn't really know what was going on. And less than half of the votes in 2020 were cast on election day. There was an enormous early vote. You know, so this is kind of the first. We've had some by-elections and things like that, but this will be shortly followed by Tasmania, which the last Tasmanian election happened much later in the COVID crisis. But this is the first of the full cycle elections we're seeing post-COVID, and we will see how much people revert to their old styles of voting, or people go, well, I like voting pre-poll, I'll keep doing that.
I think people are lazy and will vote pre-poll.
Yeah, my impression is that pre-poll is pretty ingrained in the voting patterns of people at this point. Introduced during COVID maybe, but it's just very convenient for people. You don't have to waste your Saturdays. You don't have to do anything other than take a lunch hour, go down to a polling booth, cast your vote and move on.
My office is around the corner from City Hall, which is a pre-polling booth. And let me tell you, all three of the big parties think that people are going to vote pre-poll because there's about 1,000 people lined up in front. There's a lot of volunteers and signs and stuff set up, ready to go. They think people are voting pre-poll.
Meanwhile, Brisbane City admittedly gets most of my focus. It's the only election in the area that's partisan, but we have these other big councils in the area around it. Does anyone want to jump in with any examples of stories you find interesting or particular councils in the area that are going to be grabbing your interest as the campaign closes out?
I might jump in here and spruik one of my pieces that I wrote for Guardian Australia, partly about Moreton Bay Council, because Queensland has the ignominy of having an unusually large number of uncontested elections. I try to call them prematurely elected, but they wouldn't let me say that in the paper. Anyway, so there are 15 mayors and 46 councillors who've already won, basically. And as a result of particularly the Moreton Bay Council, 150,594 people will not get a ballot this year, even though there's an election on, which is just an enormous number of people. That only happens when you have both a mayor and a councillor who aren't contested. They only have one candidate. In that instance, they just don't issue a ballot at all. So there's an enormous number of people who are essentially disenfranchised, which I think is certainly worth noting. I'm not sure why that is. I didn't get any clear explanation as to why that might be, because it is an unusually large number for these big councils with a lot of money and a lot of power. But there are uncontested seats in particularly Moreton Bay, as I said, but also in the Gold Coast. I believe there's also one in the Sunshine Coast, and there's one in Townsville, I think, and a couple more in obviously regional areas.
Oh, and don't forget Goondiwindi, you know, the mayoralty held by a former state minister.
Yes, Lawrence is obviously very happily a victor already.
I used to live out there when it wasn't Moreton Bay Regional Council, when it was Pine Rivers Council. And it only had one official mayor. Before that, they were all chair people, and that was Yvonne Chapman, a former Joe-era minister who was in there the entirety of the 90s and 00s. She was retired only when the councils were merged together. Certainly when it comes to areas like that, this is an area that's been represented by both Labor and the Liberal Party over time. It's currently represented by Peter Dutton at the federal level and by Labor nearly completely across Moreton Bay region at the moment, except for maybe some areas around the outskirts. It's political, but it's not. They're not screaming at the fences every day about the ideology and the thoughts of a government. And certainly when it comes to council politics, it's pretty apolitical. And basically, if you're doing a good enough job as mayor or councillor, there's just no interest or effort in trying to remove you from those positions. It's also really expensive to face an incumbent, especially an incumbent in a council where there's not going to be a lot of media coverage and it's probably going to be a massive electorate. Yeah, I grew up in Strathpine, it was one of the smallest electorates, and it's still massive. It's at least two-thirds the size of Pine Rivers, the overlay seat. And yeah, these are monstrous areas to try to cover. Some of them go into the bush. You'd be walking for ages if you're trying to cover it door to door. And yeah, that sort of money just doesn't appear from nowhere. It's why we had all of those scandals around various campaign PACs, where money was coming in from dark sources into campaigns to try to oust small councillors from seats. It's just more difficult. The stakes are lower and people don't care about it in the same way they care about their federal member or their state member.
Do you think that part of the reason a lot of people aren't standing this time is, I suppose, to put it delicately, the legal consequences for a lot of candidates last time? A lot of these councillors have been sacked since last election or have found themselves in front of the CCC or courts, that sort of thing. A former Moreton Bay mayor was brought before a court for that reason. An entire council was sacked elsewhere.
Ipswich and Logan both had quite significant troubles.
Yeah. Do you think that's discouraging people from running?
It certainly will be playing on people's minds, no doubt. But realistically, now that the rules are fairly embedded, it's starting to get really easy to understand where those lines are. And mostly it comes down to sensible things like not taking money from people you shouldn't be taking money from, like developers. With those rules in place that say you can't take money from developers, makes it a lot easier to stay on the right side of the law.
Well, I mean, there's two things for me that seem like they're factors. One is, I was going to say single member electorates, but it's actually majoritarian electoral systems, because even where they don't have single member electorates in Queensland, they still use a majoritarian model. So you tend to have, if the majority of the council's electorate votes as a block, they win every seat. If you had a 10 member
council with no wards and it was PR, you know, someone could get elected with 9%, and it does always mean there's room for new entrants. Whereas the majority runs a ticket of 10 candidates, and if voters are disciplined, then they win all 10 seats. That probably doesn't happen in really small councils, but it would usually happen. So I think that's a factor. Is that majoritarianism means a lot of these seats are actually safe. And then the second thing I think is the lack of parties. You know, at a federal level, lots of seats are safe, but Labor, Liberal, Greens have an incentive to put candidates up even if they're not in with a chance of winning. And I think that does have interesting consequences for the political debate. Like when there's not a political opposition in an area that is like looking for ways to damage the government, you know, like, I mean, I know that we always think of that cynically about that as being self-interested behavior, and it absolutely is. It's about trying to win power and have power for yourselves. But it also, it kind of tests a government in a way, right? Whereas if a council has a very clubby relationship where everyone's on the same page and there's that kind of consensus, it's much easier to sweep problematic issues under the table. And so the lack of parties, and I'm interested in your thoughts about why there are not political parties in a place like the Gold Coast or Moreton Bay or Sunshine Coast, why that's a factor. I have also heard a few people saying, which I'm starting to think has some legitimacy, that the Sunshine Coast, not so much a question of its size, but that it represents quite dispersed areas that don't really reflect a real community, and that's a bit problematic as well.
That's definitely true of the Sunshine Coast, no question.
Yeah, there's certainly something to be said about those council mergers at the time. Merging all of those things together sort of makes sense on the surface in the same way that it made sense for all of Brisbane, but just hasn't played out that way in reality. They're not unified.
There isn't a community of interest at all in the Sunshine Coast.
You could definitely make an argument that Runcorn has some relation to Brisbane City. It's not that far to go from the outside of Brisbane City to the centre, and there's a better than average chance that even if you don't live that close to the city, you might work somewhere within that city fairly easily, and that place will have a pretty big link to Brisbane City itself. It's not as true with the Gold Coast. There's no central business district in exactly the same way that Brisbane works. But coming back to majoritarian council wards, let's take Toowoomba Council. Now, it uses a multi-member first-past-the-post system, as we've sort of suggested already. There are 21 candidates vying for 10 positions on council there. So it can also be a matter of what is actually possible to achieve. To get across that line in Ipswich may take 10, 15% of the overall primary vote, whereas if you were trying to overturn a councillor as the only candidate facing a sitting councillor, you would have to run 50%. And it's just a big barrier.
Does anyone have thoughts on Gold Coast, second biggest council in the country, Tom Tate's the mayor running again?
Tom Tate.
Yeah, it'll be Tom Tate.
He'll be fine. Yeah. He'll have a record fourth term.
Doesn't matter what that guy says. He's said some absolutely insane things over the last 4 years. But
they love him.
It doesn't matter.
They love him. The people of the Gold Coast know who they love, and they love Tom Tate.
Yeah, they called the art gallery right next to the council chambers a portal to hell, and that's not going to affect his primary vote.
There's a big light rail issue, and one of his opponents is fighting on that issue. No, won't have any effect. He'll get elected.
Any other councils you're really interested in watching?
Redlands, not because of the likely winner, but because of the return of Andrew Lamming, will be incredibly interesting if it happens. I don't know whether he will win or not, but certainly the election campaign will be interesting. We've already written a piece about some of the goings on there, which I won't sort of go into an enormous amount. The former mayor was gone after she was convicted of drink driving after a car crash. It's chaos. It'll be interesting purely for the, I suppose, bold and the beautiful elements of the thing.
It's crazy that person, that was midterm. That was 2 years ago. That happened. She stayed in office her entire remaining term.
She's still mayor, hey?
Yeah, she's still mayor now, technically. And Andrew Lamming, oh my gosh. Is there anything happening out of Redlands that I've never seen happen in any other election? No, this is madness. It's every bit the Lars Bowman election as well. And that name recognition may be enough to get Andrew Lamy across the line.
Particularly when there's no party labels, right? Like, name recognition becomes even more important.
Well, here's the fun part. I looked it up just before we came on air. Andrew Lamming has apparently left the LNP. Like, his return says he's not a member of the LNP anymore.
Cindy Corry is challenging him. She is the former head of the Chamber of Commerce, so people maybe know who she is as well.
Ipswich and Logan are probably going to be interesting ones to watch as well. Theresa Harding is the current mayor of Ipswich. She has big LNP affiliations, and this is an area absolutely 100% known for being working class Labor. I would imagine that she has no reason to think that she's going to be turfed out just on her affiliations. She's done a pretty good job of keeping herself out of trouble and running a reasonably good council. That said, there are so many former Labor councillors under the Pasali era who are running this time, including ones that are elected at the moment, and old ones like former Mayor Anthony Antonelli, who came in after Pasali was turfed, and he has at least a decent shot of being elected as well. You wouldn't imagine it.
And the person he beat for the Ipswich mayor in 2017 at that by-election was Paul Tully. So I just cannot imagine those two people being on a council together.
It's very much going to be the case that a lot of these council seats start running back to Labor. It's going to be a long-term thing. Theresa Harding will probably age out of the system before she's voted out. But at some point in the future, this is going to be a Labor council again. And even though there aren't affiliations in the same way that, say, there are affiliations in Brisbane City Council, those things do run deep, especially considering the organising power of politicians on the ground. These councillors in the past relied on their Labor links to get action going in Ipswich. They'll be going back to that as time goes on as well.
A number of these councils have no incumbent, so Logan has no incumbent because Darren Power is retiring, been there as a councillor for 20-odd years and been as a mayor for four. And it'll be interesting to see the three candidates. One is a former member for Ford, Greg Ragus. There's a challenger called James Reid. And then there's a third Labor-affiliated person, John Raven. So it'll be interesting to see which of those gets up as well, given that it's a new open seat.
It is interesting sometimes you have these councils that are non-partisan, but the major party that dominates it and national level, it just effectively means it's a contest between different people linked to that same party, right? You know, you'll get someone linked to the Labor Party, but there's different options for the voters to consider.
Well, that was certainly the point of those reforms, was to tell us what those links actually were. So when you put in your ECQ nomination, you are required to mention all of your political affiliations. We should mention one more before we go, and that's Sunshine Coast. The mayor of Sunshine Coast, Mark Jameson, is also stepping down this time. So we're expecting a new person there as well. That's probably going to be someone with a conservative bent or someone related to the LNP as well.
Okay, well then finally, we've got these two state by-elections, Inala and Ipswich West. Inala was the seat of former Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk, and it's kind of the southwestern corner of Brisbane City Council, right up against Ipswich. And then Ipswich West is obviously in the Ipswich area. Jim Madden, who was the local member there, who'd been kind of was going to be pushed out at the election, has quit early to run for council. One of the things that's interesting here is that there's different voting systems being used in these by-elections. If you live in Inala, you'll get two optional preferential ballots for Brisbane City, and you'll get a compulsory preferential ballot for Inala. If you live in Ipswich West, you'll get three. You'll get an optional preferential ballot for the mayor of Ipswich, you'll get a compulsory preferential ballot for your state MP, and then you will get a block vote, multi-member ward ballot for Ipswich Council. Not a great system. I think probably the solution to this is just to not hold state by-elections on the same day as council elections.
Inala is literally Palaszczuk country. It's been in a Palaszczuk hand for nearly half a century at this point.
For over 40 years, yeah.
It is hard to imagine any outcome other than a rather large Labor majority. Maybe reduced, but it'll be large. It gets a little harder when we start talking about Ipswich West, because when we start talking about Ipswich West, we've got to talk about Jim Madden and his various, let's say, indiscretions in government. It's not been a fun time for him, and certainly if he didn't decide to run for council, it's quite possible he could have been pushed out in any pre-selection that was held there. This also comes on the top of an ongoing garbage problem in this area. The smell, the garbage tips, and the contractors associated with those have been a sort of looming factor over Labor's time in office under Palaszczuk and now under Miles. Stephen Miles was a signatory to one of the contracts associated with this. So expect that Labor might be in a little bit of trouble or be closer than we would otherwise think in a place where Labor should do very well. But saying that, I don't know if the Liberals have the firepower to take Ipswich West.
Ipswich is the original heartland of One Nation, right? Could they be a factor there?
As you say, the One Nation took Ipswich West in 98 during the big explosion of that party, and I believe it was at that time part of Pauline Hanson's federal seat as well, at least most of Ipswich was. So certainly Labor will be looking to their right and also to their further right for challenges there. With crime being a major issue at state level, it's just inevitable that that will get brought up in the by-election. Alexis is right to say Inala will be safe as houses. They'll obviously, Anastasia Palaszczuk as the Premier will have a personal vote, which will be lost, but I don't think there's any real chance of them losing that seat. But yes, Ipswich West, in a very bad day for Labor, could be lost potentially to a Liberal candidate preference by One Nation, or in an incredibly bad day for Labor to a One Nation candidate, as I have done before.
So that's about it for this episode of the Tally Room podcast. Thanks to Andrew for joining me.
No worries. Thanks for inviting me.
And thanks, Alexis.
No problems. Thanks.
You can find this podcast on your podcast app of choice. If you like the show, please consider rating or reviewing us on iTunes. You can follow the Tally Room on Mastodon at tallyroom@mastodon.au or like us on Facebook. This podcast is made possible thanks to the generous support of our donors on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/tallyroom, where you can now start reading. I've got a new fortnightly newsletter for Patreon donors. The most recent one gives my thoughts on the whole spin game around the Dunkley by-election. So if you sign up as a Patreon donor, you can check that out. Information about this podcast is available at tallyroom.com.au, and you can email questions or feedback to thetallyroom@gmail.com. Thanks to Chris DeBro for writing the music you hear in this episode. Once again, thanks for listening.